You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of CEO Perspectives, a signature podcast series by the Conference Board. CEO Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, nonpartisan look at a range of timely topics which matter most to business leaders. To help make sense of these topics and how they'll unfold, we'll sit down with thought leaders and do what we do best at the Conference Board, provide trusted insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this podcast series, and today's conversation will focus on NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. What is it? Why was it founded? How does it operate today? And what's going on with all the discussion around NATO? Joining me today is the president of CED, the Public Policy Center of the Conference Board, Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray. And Lori, welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
So Lori, you know, you've taught at the Naval Academy and in many universities. You're an expert on all of these subjects. But, you know, let's just start basically with the history behind NATO. How did it come about? What was its purpose? And, you know, who were the original member states?
So the history of NATO, Steve, is extremely important in terms of understanding today. It was really established to counter the Soviet expansion and threat in Europe. So it's a multilateral European collective defense alliance when it was founded in 1949. Its purpose was to protect democratic values and provide collective security. Now, you had a really devastated Europe. The Soviets were moving in. There were tensions with the Soviet Union during the war when they were an ally in terms of where they were positioning their troops as we were allies trying to end the war. And then, of course, after the war, their encroachment on Eastern Europe and what they were doing, particularly in Czechoslovakia and other Eastern European countries, Hungary, really had an impact on, and of course, Berlin in 1948, really had an impact on how the United States was seeing this growing and developing threat, and how the Europeans, who economy and military were exhausted and the economy was devastated, really wanted the U.S. support militarily for deterrence. And Great Britain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg actually came together in 1948 with a foundational military security alliance, the Brussels Treaty, that served as the basis for NATO. What's really interesting before I get to membership, though, Steve, is I just want to say a little bit about what was happening in the U.S. While the Soviet Union remained on a war footing, the U.S., the American public was thrilled the war was over. They were exhausted. They were welcoming the troops home. We were cutting defense budgets. And in the meantime, the Truman administration was watching this encroaching threat to Europe and the Soviet expansion. And you know, there was a lot of attention being paid within the national security community to this. But there wasn't much awareness in the American public. And President Truman invites Winston Churchill to come in 1946, who made his very famous Iron Curtain speech. And that's really considered the beginning of the Cold War, that there was an Iron Curtain descending in Europe. But it was also the beginning of American awareness on the public level that there was to build support for what was really a very unconventional expansion of US national security to actually protect Europe and to have a military alliance with Europe. So, yeah, really significant.
Yeah, so this history is just really incredibly important, as you said. You know, Europe had come through, you know, 6-7 years of war. It was destroyed. You know, most of Western Europe was destroyed. Germany was defeated. And then you have this rising power in the East, who were nominally allies to defeat Germany, but all of a sudden they started displaying, you know, their intentions to expand. And it was like, here we go again. And so this was a reaction from, you know, the whole group of nations. We can't, you know, we've got to set up this block. So Lori, the other thing you have to point out is the Marshall Plan was being implemented at the same time. We have to give a recognition to your organization, the Committee for Economic Development, which wrote the Marshall Plan, and CED's chair was the first administrator of the Marshall Plan. So you had all of this Western influence going on to rebuild Europe, and at the same time facing this new threat from the East, right? So it's all in that context.
Right. And what's really important here too, Steve, and as you mentioned that the Committee for Economic Development's role was absolutely critical, was the bipartisanship that happened at this time. It was the business community working with the administration to establish the Marshall Plan and Republicans and Democrats coming together on the economic front. And on the military front, you really have a foundational transformation in terms of how the United States is looking at national security issues with Senator Vandenberg from Michigan. He was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican from Michigan. And he laid down that the principle that has guided US foreign policy since the end of World War II, which is that politics on national security ends at the water's edge, and we become bipartisan, and we work together with allies to create a collective security for a peaceful, democratic, prosperous world.
So there were 12 founding members. Talk about who was there, and then how it's expanded over time.
Yeah, and the 12 founding members, you know, this is a North Atlantic alliance. It was it included all of the major countries in Europe, France, Iceland, obviously the UK, Denmark, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, but also Canada, which is critical because it is a North Atlantic alliance. And Iceland is part of that North Atlantic, not European. It's US, Canada, Iceland. From the 12 founding members, you really then, in terms of expansion of membership, and I also want to point out that the NATO treaty has never been changed. It's been viable throughout its whole 70 some odd year history. There were two major membership expansion periods, and it really caused quite a debate both within the United States and within Europe as to whether NATO should expand after the Soviet Union collapsed. And President Clinton was very committed to solidifying the democratic gains that happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union, was very much in favor of expansion. UK and France were a little bit more skeptical. The UK didn't want to dilute the alliance, and France didn't want it to happen through an institution that the US played a prominent role, wanted it to have expansion and inclusion happen in European institutions. And nonetheless, it's a consensus organization. It went ahead in 1999. You see Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, really important countries coming into NATO, important for us in terms of locking in the democratic advances that were happening and the market economies that were being established. But also what you're seeing on the Russian side is concern among constituencies in Russia, conservative constituencies in Russia, which Putin in the following year becomes head of Russia, exemplifies about how this is taking advantage of Russia's weakness. Next big expansion, again, filling that theme that Putin is continuing to harp on in terms of, you know, how NATO, how the U.S., how the world took advantage of Russia when it was weakest. In 2004, you see the Baltic states come in. Right, you know, they were actually Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. That was actually Russian territory, not just a Soviet Union territory. It was part of the Soviet Union, as opposed to countries in Eastern Europe where the Soviet Union had influence. So that was a big turning point, both in terms of the expansion and the really trying to solidify the democratic gains on the US and European side. And on the Russian side, it was seen as a violation of their security perimeter, as well as a slap in the face to them in terms of their areas of security areas.
Yeah, so you know, so we're up to 30 members now, with the last one being North Macedonia in 2020. That's the country just north of Greece. So, but there are others that are trying to get in. Who are
right.
those?
Right, and that's the other important years. You have 1999, 2004, that helps to explain what's happening today. 2008, President George W. Bush says that Georgia and Ukraine can become members of NATO. He doesn't put a date on it. And that's in April of 2008. In the meantime, that was a tipping point in terms of Russian reaction and Putin's reaction. And you see almost immediately the Russians, with an excuse of what was happening in Georgia, who was becoming very close to the West, the Russians go into Georgia, and you have the war in Georgia between in 2008 between Russia and the Georgian government. Still, Russian troops are still in Georgia, splitting that country, and you have the precursor to what's happening in Ukraine.
Right. So, you know, this is interesting because if people think about NATO as being sort of, you know, an economic alliance, it is not an economic alliance. It is strictly a defense alliance, as you said. You know, we have other mechanisms for, you know, with the trade treaties and so forth. So I think sometimes politicians today get it conflated, you know, as to what the purpose is. But it's strictly a defense treaty, and it was strictly focused on the USSR, and which now has, you know, fallen and become Russia. So that's the context that leads us to today. And till today, it is a defense treaty, and it is focused on making sure to protect the integrity of the Western European and North Atlantic states from, you know, a potentially aggressive Russia.
Right, exactly. It is a collective security treaty. It is a defense treaty. It was to complement what was happening on the economic side in terms of building up European economies. What's significant, though, is that it is a collective security treaty to protect democratic institutions, democracies, and the rule of law. And today, in order to become a member of NATO, you need to be a democratic country, and you have to have abide by market principles in terms of your economy. So that's the connection between the two, but it is a collective security treaty organization. And the core principle is Article 5. We've heard a lot about over the past several years, which is attack against one is an attack against all. And the only time that's ever been invoked was in 2001, after the attack, after 9/11 and the attack on New York and the World Trade Centers, which is when NATO invoked the Article 5 as a significant show of support to the United States, which this was the first time, as you know, we were attacked since our national, you know, we had actually been attacked in terms of our borders since Pearl Harbor. And but it was also a deterrent, a message to the perpetrators that America was not going to be left alone. NATO invoked Article 5, and there was your collective security deterrence.
Yeah, and what a huge irony that this whole organization was brought together to sort of lean on the strength of the United States, and the only time Article 5 has ever been invoked was when the United States was attacked, and everybody came to our support, which is really very interesting. Just quickly, so it's headquartered in Brussels. How's it funded?
In fact, the principal way it's funded is that each national country dedicates its troops to NATO and pays for those troops. So given the large role of the United States, we pay about 70% of NATO defense. So there is a structural operations infrastructure budget, which is about $3 billion. And the US pays, you know, its piece of that, which is larger as it is with all international organizations than other countries. But the fundamental controversy over how much the US pays is over this dedication of troops. And actually that has gone up since the end of the Cold War. We paid about 50%, compared to other NATO countries for NATO defense prior to the end of the Cold War. We're about 70% now.
Yeah, and so, you know, everybody has to commit 2% of their GDP, and that's sort of the threshold. And it's been the rub because not everybody has done that.
Right. And that was an agreement in 2014 at the Wales Summit. The countries made a commitment to 2% of their gross domestic product. That's not actually part of the treaty, but it was a way of addressing this concern and pushback that was happening in terms of the NATO alliance and how it is paid for, that if the countries would provide 2% of their gross domestic product by 2024. And there's a real shortfall in that. Of the 30 members, it's probably less than half have actually met that 2% threshold.
We've talked about why NATO was formed and how it operates. Next, we'll discuss the potential reforms to its structure and what NATO's actions could mean for relations with China and Russia. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast from the Conference Board. In this episode, we are providing insights from our just-released C-Suite Outlook. This annual report examines how CEOs are looking at the tsunami of changes coming their way and how they plan to respond. In keeping with our mission at the Conference Board, we provide trusted insights for what's ahead for you and your business. Whether you are a CEO, in the C-suite, or seeking practical preparation for a changing world, you will find actionable ideas to help your organization navigate 2022. You can read the report, listen to upcoming podcasts, watch future webcasts, and find interactive charts on our website at conference-board.org.
Welcome back to CEO Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board, and I'm joined by the president of the Committee for Economic Development, which is the Public Policy Center of the Conference Board, President Dr. Lori Esposito Murray. So Lori, you know, this whole thing has been going on now for 72 years. NATO has been going on for 72 years. Article 5 has only been invoked once. You know, as you look back, was this a good idea? You know, what's worked and what hasn't?
Steve, it was an excellent idea. It preserved the peace in Europe. You had a real vulnerable Europe at the end of World War II. The U.S. committing its support in a collective security agreement as the Soviet Union was encroaching really helped preserve the peace, not only right after the war, but helped build that preservation and foundational preservation of deterrence as nuclear weapons were exploding, no pun intended, in terms of expanding as part of defense capabilities and defense strategy. So it was a very good idea. The problems have been really its difficulty in evolving after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Basically, NATO was shocked by the collapse of the Soviet Union. They were also shocked by 9/11. And 9/11 represented this whole new world of threats, non-state actors. And as we just discussed, NATO was set up to counter the principal threat in Europe, which was the former Soviet Union. So they had difficulty evolving in terms of these gray area threats, terrorism, cyber attacks, how to respond. And as a consensus organization, and it was expanding, so the membership was getting larger. But it did evolve, and it did develop its 10-year strategic concepts to move against those types of threats, but it had difficulty doing that. It also had difficulty figuring out the new Russia's role in Europe and in NATO. You know, that's really significant. I think historians will be arguing and debating about this for years to come as to when the Soviet Union had collapsed, Russia was a nascent democratic country. There were real problems about the security apparatus was still very much in place in Russia from the former Soviet Union. You know, just how to fit Russia in was you know, slow, difficult, and Russia was also feeling aggrieved by the expansion of NATO.
Right. Well, people probably don't remember, and this was 1991, the Berlin Wall falls, and then the Soviet Union collapses. And there was great discussion. Gee, do we need NATO anymore? Let's just disband it because it's not necessary because the Soviet Union is no longer a threat. When in fact, it was actually a very precarious time because the nuclear arsenal was distributed among Soviet states. And, you know, nobody knew who had control over what armaments and so forth. And it could have been a disaster. So in fact, NATO held together during this time. And then, of course, you know, Russia has risen and become, you know, not a democratic state, let's just put it that way, and kind of is trying to reform the Soviet Union. So it's really gone through some interesting times.
Yeah, and to that point, Brent Scowcroft said when he was National Security Advisor, in a blink of an eye, the Soviet Union collapsed, the Cold War ended, and not a shot was fired, but the entire world changed. The geostrategic world changed in the blink.
The whole world definitely changed. So in your view now, sitting here today, what reforms do you think we need to make, that NATO needs to make, you know, either in terms of their charter, their structure, or their members?
Right now is a really, again, a precarious time and an important time for NATO. And they're actually doing a new strategic concept, which they do every 10 years for 2022. They've got to face not only non-state actors advancing technology in terms of weaponry, but also a focus now on China. They've actually are pivoting to the threat that China is playing. And if you see concerns about the gas pipelines, Nord Stream 2 in Europe in terms of Russia, the economic complexities of the interactions with China and NATO allies and how that will affect, and then NATO members and how that will affect their attitudes about building consensus on how to respond is going to be quite complex. But I think the two main issues to focus on, there's a lot of discussion about institutional reform, which is important because you have many more countries and it is a consensus organization. But I think the two central questions are membership, the expansion of NATO. Does it continue to expand? What happens to Ukraine? What happens to Georgia? And, you know, how does that, and even expansion beyond that, and has that affect the mission, the cohesion, and how NATO can actually make decisions and move those decisions out?
Well, the key question here is Ukraine, because that is right. Sitting there on the border of the NATO countries, and you know it's the buffer for Russia, and you know we have over 100,000 troops. You know, latest estimates are that we have Russia has over 150,000 troops sitting on the border, ready to invade. And they're threatening, and they want to promise that Ukraine will never join NATO, ironically driving Sweden and Finland to raise their hands just in the last month saying, we want to join. So, you know, should we bring Sweden and Finland in? Should we bring Ukraine in, or should we not?
So what's interesting about Sweden and Finland is that these were two really important countries in terms of their neutrality as serving as conduits for conflict with the Soviet Union, with a contentious Russia. But the fact that they are really considering coming in is just symbolic of how serious the conflict and the tensions are in Europe and Russian aggression in Europe and the threat of Russia and Putin's strategy in Europe. Whether Ukraine should come in or not has been debated extensively. As a matter of fact, President George W. Bush was actually criticized for saying Ukraine should come in and Georgia because he didn't put a timeline on it. And so he sent out the signal that he, the United States and NATO believe that they should be members of considered for NATO membership and should become members of NATO. At the same time, they did not become members of NATO, so they didn't fall under Article 5. And you saw, you know, as I mentioned, the civil war in Georgia in 2008, and now you're seeing from 2014, Putin moving out against Ukraine. You know, as you know, he's already annexed Crimea, is in the Donbass region. Russian troops are in the Donbass region, and there's a lot of controversy and civil conflict there. And now we are on the precipice of potential war in Europe if Putin decides to move into Ukraine.
Yeah, and the media seems to be missing this, Lori. You know, this is probably the biggest dangerous flashpoint we've had probably since the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you have a potential war, and one side is saying, if we don't, you know, allow Ukraine to come in, we're dooming it to be overrun and annexed by Russia. On the other hand, people say, if we do bring Ukraine in, it will create the danger. It will create a war because Russia will then have to do it. Do you have a view of one side versus the other?
You know, I think we have to see how this plays out right now. It has been described as the lowest point in U.S.-Russian history since the end of the Cold War. I actually think that's even an understatement. It's not only the lowest point, but we're on the precipice of a real conflict. And
so the lowest point. So this is the most dangerous point. Even when Khrushchev was throwing shoes
since the end of the Cold War.
Since the end of the Cold War. Okay.
Since 1990, okay. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that this is the lowest point. And it's worse than the lowest point, because I think we really are on the precipice of war. And Putin is, we are really waiting to see what Putin has to say and trying to use negotiations. And obviously, whether Ukraine should come in or not, that is not a, first of all, it's not a question for today, but there is a value here, as it's a value that we have upheld we have upheld that no country has the right, particularly the Soviet Union or Russia, has the right to tell us who should come in and who should not come in. This is a very sensitive diplomatic issue. I don't think we cannot violate the principle that another country can say who comes in and who doesn't come in. because I think that would really have a tremendous impact on the morale of Europe and NATO. But at the same time, it's interesting. It's a really complex problem. And the question is whether what I find fascinating about Putin's demands in terms of de-escalating the crisis is that we're looking at security arrangements that existed under arms control agreements that he's basically looking at to be restored. And you know, whether it was the conventional forces in Europe, the INF agreement, you know, all treaties that he has violated that helped to provide security parameters and exchanges of information. It's a really complex problem, and we're having a hard time figuring out what Putin's thinking is, in part because, you know, he really holds the cards on this and he's making the major moves. But the other piece of this is, which is fascinating, is COVID's impact, that Putin is very isolated. You have to isolate before you actually come in to see him, to meet with him. So there are advisors playing even a more distant role in his autocratic rule in Russia. Yeah.
Well, a final question in our last couple of minutes, but, you know, there is also the whole juxtaposition of China in this, which has become a very active adversary. You know, they're obviously a trading partner, a business partner of the United States. We have most of our manufacturing there now, which you can argue was not a very smart thing to do, but here we are. And so you have all of this sitting there, and, you know, there's the argument that an expansion of NATO will actually push Russia and China together, and which would create this behemoth adversary to the West and potentially change the dynamics of global power. You know, a really precarious time, Laurie.
It is. And as you know, as I mentioned earlier, the economic piece of China's engagement in the economies of the NATO countries is far more developed, far more entrenched, and will cause far more complexities and conflict in terms of how to respond to the Chinese security threat as NATO moves in that direction. But NATO is moving in that direction. You're going to see this in the 2022 new strategic concept. And I just want to just get me back to the Ukraine crisis, because it also very much relates to China and how to respond to China, is that when you were asking whether Ukraine should become a member of NATO, NATO is a consensus organization. And so you really need to do, and the administration is moving out to do this week, NATO is meeting this week, but you've got to get consensus on how to deal with the Ukraine problem, because we have to, it is a collective security agreement. So the point being that Germany was reluctant to actually say that Ukraine should become a member, because this is when the issue was coming up in the early 2000s. And also how provocative to be to the Russians, since that is a country and right on its border had, you know, as I mentioned, had been a significant part of Russian history. And so how provocative to be in terms of NATO expansion Russia. And France, for its own reasons, had concerns. And so, but you have to bring NATO to consensus if collective security is going to work. And that really is as important in terms of, as we're watching these hours and days go by, in terms of how this conflict is going to end, getting a collective agreement politically from NATO. And it is the overarching structure is, it is democratic institutions, democratic governments. And so the military is under political rule. Getting that North Atlantic Council consensus agreement on how to deal with Ukraine is absolutely critical. And will be so with China as well. And we're going to see whether NATO can withstand the pressures of reaching that consensus with a much larger expanded NATO, different national security interests and perspectives from each of the countries.
Right. And the decision that they have to make is not only, you know, it doesn't, you don't have to let Ukraine into NATO and bring them in to defend them should there be a Russian invasion. So there are multiple discussions that go, NATO could choose to defend Ukraine without having them as a member. Laurie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Steve. Really appreciate it.
And thanks to all of you for listening in to CEO Perspectives. Every few weeks, I'll be joined by a prominent thought leader to provide insights on the issues of our time. We'll cover leading topics in economics, public policy, ESG, human capital, and more. Please share CEO perspectives with your colleagues, with your relatives, with your friends, with your pets. Well, maybe not your pets. I'm Steve Odlin, and this podcast has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You have been listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.